Hello, my name's Jane Dacre. Welcome to this Medical Women Talking podcast. Medical Women Talking is a series of recordings of informal interviews with a range of women doctors from different specialties and backgrounds who've had successful careers in medicine. I'm a proud physician and have had the privilege of a very fulfilling career. As I get older and have reflected on my own journey, I've become increasingly passionate about helping other women to achieve their potential in medicine. Combining life and a career can be challenging, and it sometimes feels extremely difficult to keep going. The women in these conversations have all found a way to thrive and have achieved great things. I hope that you'll be inspired by their stories. The podcasts are available to download in any order so that you can listen and be inspired whilst doing other things. Happy listening. Today, I'm talking to Jennifer Dixon. She's the Chief Executive of the Health Foundation. She qualified as a doctor, but has had a career in policy. This is something that some people may want to do because clinical medicine isn't for everybody. She's been hugely successful in that, but has done things differently. So I commend her approach to you. Please listen and learn.
Can we just start off by you talking about your career journey so far? So why did you decide to become a doctor?
Well, I suppose two reasons, really. One was I really liked science. I was quite fierce about it and really interested at the right time that you choose your A-levels. And I also, you know, like many people, it's sort of a cliche, isn't it? I kind of felt I wanted to do something with purpose and help. So I think those are the two main reasons. But the other thing was I was very interested in, at that point, in international travel. And in particular, I was very interested in East Africa for various reasons. And so I thought that if I trained in medicine, that I might be able to travel a bit, but particularly might be able to contribute to health somehow in East Africa. I had no idea how, but nevertheless, those three reasons, I think, were the main ones.
Thank you. And so how did you go about that?
Go about the...
Getting through your career and getting to achieve your aims.
Yes. Well, I think the first thing to say is that my aims were sort of blown off course pretty early on. I think the first thing was I did actually take a year off between school and university, and I went to Kenya, and I taught chemistry and physics in a bush school right on the Kenya-Uganda border. And actually, to be honest, I was still deciding whether to do medicine or not. I was in two minds because one part was very arty and the other part was very sciencey. But nevertheless, I went there and then I decided, well, I perhaps ought to do medicine in before I figure out what else to do with the arty side. So I then went to medical school, Bristol, which was fantastic. And part of the detour started when at medical school, I just got really interested in student union politics and got elected onto the student union council. And I just got very interested in party political, just politics more generally, and why the country was run as it was, what was the role of the state, why was the health service constantly underfunded, it seemed. So as I was going through medical school, I was particularly interested in those things. And over time, my interest in the science was still there, but it got superseded by domestic considerations about politics. So then that set up a kind of almost a conflict in my own mind as to whether medicine itself, enjoyable though it was with the science and the patients, was going to fulfill this other need, which was really to consider the state of the country. This sounds rather grandiose, doesn't it? But, you know, the state of the country, why we set up the health system as it was, why the public sector was as it was, why we made certain political decisions about the state. So there was that kind of tension. But I carried that throughout and finished medicine. And then went on to do house jobs. But that tension grew and grew. And at some point later on, which we can get on to, it became too difficult to sustain, and I had to jump one way or the other. And actually, I then retrained into policy analysis.
So that's a really, really interesting thing, and something that I think I can see now in quite a lot of young people coming through medicine at the moment, that they have the opportunity at university and beyond to look at the system and say, well, this isn't right. How can we look at it? How can we make it better? It sounds as if that was the kind of thing. And I think there are lots of people now, given the NHS that we currently are working in, or health systems that we currently work in, probably think the same way. But there isn't a proper career track, or is there?
So it's a good point there, Jane. And I was just reflecting on this point recently because I am in a nice position of being able to select Harkness Fellowships. I don't know if you know this fellowship programme. For those listening, it's a really interesting opportunity to spend a year in the United States. It's sort of mid-career for a year. And we are in selecting, a lot of candidates, a lot of whom are doctors. And what's absolutely clear is they are doing masses. These are people around 29, 30, and they have been clinical fellows at the Department of Health, at NHS England. They've been DARSI fellows. They've gone to NICE and had all sorts of attachments to different parts of the system in the way that it just simply wasn't possible for somebody like me. I mean, you were considered slightly weird if you veered off the clinical track. But now it's much more acceptable, which is fantastic progress. And there's no doubt that young people have a much wider purview and really don't want to be just boxed into clinical medicine. Some really do, and that's completely fine, but some really don't. So I think it's more and more possible to forge a path to combine both of these things. And I think that's really, really healthy. It does mean that we might lose some people from the clinical coalface to work in sort of the system more widely, so to speak. But I think that's really healthy. And I think what we need to do in the future is to enable a kind of almost revolving door to happen between people who are on want to do clinical work and also want to have this other purview. So that's progress made, but there's still a lot more progress, I think, to allow more flexibility for people to stretch the other talents that they have. And, in my generation, which is a long time ago now, it really was quite binary. You either did clinical medicine or you jumped ship and found some other landing spot that allowed you to develop these other things. And in my day, the real jumping off point was public health that allowed you to do that. And so that's one of the reasons why soon after, I think I did 5 years of clinical medicine, and then I realized that I needed to stretch this other bit. And, taking a year off to do the MSc at the London School of Hygiene in public health, being exposed to public health, did help me get off the wards to enable myself to think about which channel was best to sort into. Was it really medicine, or was it public health, or was it something wider? So public health was the only route to almost try to examine that and think and to sort yourself into a different role. Now you can do it much earlier, so that's fantastic. And I really encourage people to do that where they can.
I agree. I once heard somebody say that if you're interested in patients, you can sometimes have a much more positive impact on the patient in front of you by standing back and pulling policy levers than you are by just treating the person with diabetes. So presumably it took me a long time to realise that. You must have realised it earlier on, I suppose.
Well, I suppose what I felt, the psychologists have this really... a sort of phrase of it. There's a bit of pathology called splitting, and I think I probably exhibited this split, so that this sort of, on the one hand there was a science sort of side, and the other side there was really a completely different side, which was really interested in policy and economics. And I couldn't see then how these two things could fit. Now, as I say, it's much easier. But actually, with the medics that I see, quite a lot come to me around the ages of around 29, 30. They've achieved a lot. They've got to a particular position and they're thinking to themselves, is this what all there is? Is there something more that I can do? So it's a classic, and that's when these people apply generally to this fellowship program and other things. And I think it's really important to pause at that point and just reflect, because there's still a lot of working life ahead. How are you sorted into the right channel? Are you doing the right blend of things for you, that given your talents? And how best can you forge a way to combine things that really would work? And a lot of medics, in my experience, actually are not really interested in the politics or the economics side of things, as I was. But they are interested in bigger service changes, how best to make improvements across services, for example. That's closer to home. Or they might be interested in NICE and what NICE does. So there's a number of sort of channels that you can take which aren't directly patient care but nevertheless are linked to it. And it doesn't have to be, on the one hand, you're on the wards dealing with your patient with diabetes and the next minute you've got an attachment to the cabinet office. It doesn't have to be quite so stark. It could also be something that's related to your work, but you want to be part of, say, a national collaborative to improve diabetes care across the country, working with one of the clinical directors. So there's a whole range of things now. And if it doesn't exist, I think you just go out there and try and make it happen. And, you know, just forge a path as people before have done. And it's all to go for, I think, if you've got the energy.
So, I mean, it sounds as if that's what you did.
Yeah.
When you say you decided to jump ship, but in fact, maybe you were just driving the ship in a different direction. So how did that feel at the time? Because that strikes me as being quite a brave thing to do. And sometimes, particularly as women, we don't really feel terribly brave about our careers. How did that feel? What was it that drove you on to do that?
Yes, well, I kind of, what happened was, I did 5 years of paediatric, clinical medicine. I was doing paediatric medicine, sort of neonatal a lot, actually. And I decided to keep a diary. And I said to myself, if my diary on reflections doesn't change much in the next year or two, I've really got to do something about it. And the diary was mostly about, what have I learned? Am I moving forwards, not in a career way, but in intellectual way? In paediatrics, I wasn't really. So then I decided to apply to do public health. I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest, but somebody did say, if you do this public health course to become a consultant in public health, if you start the training course, then you can have a year off to do an MSc at the London School of Hygiene. So that's what I did. And that was what that did for me, was it exposed you to all sorts of things to be able to sort yourself more fully. So you were exposed to statistics, epidemiology, communicable disease control, sociology, policy and economics, et cetera, et cetera. And it soon became obvious, it was like catnip. I was quite surprised. The policy and economic side was just like, I suddenly felt alive. And so I then thought, okay, I'm this is back to my student union roots. There's obviously something there that really is the basic denominator of which science was grafted onto the top. So I better take this seriously. And so I basically pursued that, Jane, and was lucky enough to do a Harkness Fellowship in the United States just after the MSc. So I really wallowed in, healthcare reform, US style, and got into, Capitol Hill, interviewing all these senators and Congress people and in the center and then in the various states, and really did a political study about why healthcare reform was so blocked in the United States. Then I came back, I just thought, this is the thing for me. So I ended up doing a PhD at the London School of Hygiene, not on policy, actually, but on quantitative analysis, because I thought, if I'm a policy analyst, I'm really going to have to understand the quant. So I taught myself Bayesian modelling, multivariate analysis, all that stuff, just to be able to feel that I was tooled up. So it's almost like retraining after medicine up to the same standard that I had felt I had got to in medicine. So I really felt it. I was retrained, not additionally trained as a medic, but retrained And so that's what happened. And then I was all set for an academic life, but then I got a call to the King's Fund just hoiked me in there. And then as soon as I was in the King's Fund, it was just an environment that really suited me. So I was at the King's Fund working in their policy department, really loved it. And there was a very famous moment where, if you'll allow me a little anecdote, I was talking to my lovely boss there at the time, Nick Mays, who's still a professor at the London School of Hygiene. And we'd written an editorial about the state of the NHS and what needed to be done about it. I mean, we were so grandiose, really. And I said to Nick, why don't they ever listen to us? If only they ever did this. And at that time, I received a phone call from the Department of Health. Would I consider a job to be the policy advisor of the chief executive of the NHS, Alan Langlands? It was just a priceless moment. And then I went into the department for a couple of years before then coming out and then continuing the policy analysis route. So anyway, sorry, that's rather a long-winded way, but that's what happened, really.
So the passion for what you do comes through. Have you had highs and lows? What have been the best bits and what have been the worst bits?
I think what happened, just to link that back to your last question, which I failed to answer, Jane, which was, it didn't feel like a risk, all of this. Jumping off clinical medicine was a bit of a risk, but I always felt I could go back to it if I fell flat on my proverbial. So I had a kind of insurance policy. But to be honest, once I'd really got into the groove that I was have described, it was so energizing and so fulfilling that I didn't feel that there was any risk in involved at all. And I still had my GMC, you know, registration number. I could still go back if the worst came to the worst. So there've been a lot of highs, I guess, is the answer to mm-hmm. to the problem. I haven't felt as if there've been enormous barriers at all. The highs have been where we've done a piece of analysis and really influenced something. And there are quite a lot of examples of that, that I hope we've made a difference. But I think helping my main contribution, my main interest is not to, dare I say it, that there are people who are really motivated by making change. And for me, I shouldn't confess this, Jane, but that is a secondary thing for me. The primary thing is that we have more insight in order to act better. So it's what Rudolf Klein used to say. Rudolf Klein was the doyen of policy analysis, really, for many years. Wonderful writer and academic. And he wrote a book called Only Dissect. So what he meant by that was, if you just dissect the issues more fully and gain the insights, then you can act more appropriately. And so I think I'm in that camp, which is much more of an academic orientation. So anyway, the highs would be insights, would be landing analysis, would be helping to the NHS just strengthen its arguments for more money is quite a significant sort of groove that I've been on. And helping to them to learn from other countries. So lots of examples there. The lows, I don't think there've been many lows, really. I mean, I had a moment where early on in my career, I produced a piece, an analysis with some colleagues on GP fund holding, which, if you remember, was very contentious at the time. And Virginia Bottomley, who was the Secretary of State at the time, stood up in Parliament and referred to this paper by Dr. And she said, this was not the best paper the BMJ have ever published, she said, because it was counter to what the... So that wasn't really a low, but I got a bit paranoid that I might be followed around by a Black Mariah at one point. But no, I don't think there have been lows. I think the lows are more when you've got a political environment where no one's listening and it's just really disappointing and depressing. And we've had a lot of that recently, haven't we? So I think that's more generally it.
Okay, that That's great. So you've talked very much about what's inspired you and driven you and your sort of your academic approach really to policy, which I have to say is welcome, but it is rather depressing when it feels like nobody's listening. I think we all get that. So along the way, who's been helpful to you? Where have you found your inspiration?
Well, I think everyone is helped by a lot of people, and so I suppose lots of people have influenced me along the way. I think I've never had a mentor. I've always probably totally erroneously felt I could figure this out, and I think that's dangerous to think that, but nevertheless, that's what I have thought. But there are a couple of people I think who along the way have really been very, very insightful in different ways. One of them is Alan Langlands, who was the chief exec of the NHS when I was working with him at the Department of Health. And I think I've learned most from him because he's just so very wise and insightful and deeply human. And coming from a different tradition to me, you know, obviously male, older, a manager, but seemed to have a really all-round intelligence and was very, very interested in, very strategic and very interested in people. And I just learned a lot from that because someone like me can be quite, early on in my career, is quite fierce and almost quite robotic about science, you know, really, you know, as you are, you know, you're quite humorless, aren't you, when you're kind of fiercely driven. And I think he helped me to sort of sit back a bit and think much more widely about a variety and working through people as opposed to totally working through abstract evidence and science or whatever it is. So he's very, very helpful. And I think the other person who, I mean, he'd probably roll his eyes and step back a few miles to hear me say this, but I do think that I found Simon Stevens very inspiring and as a peer. And there's nothing like someone who's around your age, he's a bit younger, to really inspire when you see someone who is so gifted. I find that inspiring. And then there have been other people who've helped. And I think Carol Black, as my chair at Nuffield Trust, also has been incredibly generous and again deeply human at a very personal level. So I think they've all collaterally, not direct, indirectly, have been people who I've thought about and have been inspired by, and I'm very grateful for. But many, many other people indeed have been very, very helpful.
It's great to hear. It's interesting. In the women that we've been talking to, there are some names that come up more than once, and certainly Carol is one of those people that's inspired an awful lot of people of the next generation.
She's very generous. Yes. I love that quality. I think, and it's something that I've had to think about over time. Not that I feel ungenerous, hopefully not, but that I would like to contribute more as time has gone on and to other humans, as opposed to focus on the issues the whole time, which is where you can often focus.
Yes. It's kind of easier sometimes, isn't it, to focus on the issues or the data. So can I move over to the human side of things? Because you've had a stellar career, often for women particularly who've had a fantastic career. There have been some difficulties, some ructions, ups and downs in their family lives. So how have you balanced all of that? That's something that the young women coming through when they're earlier on in their career and maybe they have their first child or maybe they have caring responsibilities, it appears to be a big struggle, maybe more of a struggle now for different reasons than it was for us.
Yes, it is a real struggle. And I have to say, for me, having children was far more difficult than anything at work. I mean, I just some women find it much easier. And I found it really, really hard to the whole all of it was so so different. Very, very, very wonderful, of course. Well, I think what happened to me was that I had my children very late. So I'd already established quite a lot before I had them, which I think helps because I wasn't kind of forgotten about when I, so I'd set up a secure perch. So I had my first child when I was 41 and my second child at 46. And by the way, in brackets, please don't leave it that late, close brackets, because it's very, very risky. I just was lucky and lots of people are not. But anyway, as a result of having it late, two things. One is that, as I said, you achieve more, you're slightly known, you have a secure platform and you have a bit more money. So that meant that I could afford a nanny who made it all possible. And also that because I had the nanny and I was then able to go back. So what I did was with both of them, I had 6 months off to have maternity leave. And then I went back full time after that. And I was very, very lucky to have a very good nanny, the same nanny throughout, but for nearly 10 years. And so she made it all possible. But even with the nanny who was not living, she was 9 till 6 or 8:30 till 6. It's just a long graft because, you know, we all know about working evenings. We all know about, you come in, deal with the children, feed them, read them to them, bath them, put them to bed and then go back to work, which is what I did until about 10:30, 11. And you're exhausted, of course, when they're ill. But I just sort of, I don't know how, looking back now, how it was done, but you just do that. So that's how I did. My husband is also working full time. He's an academic. So what was good about that was that he didn't tend to work away very much. So he was at home and he had regular hours. But he, like me, had to work in the evenings because he was writing papers and all that. But it was a regular, predictable style of job. But our household, it was very, very evenly balanced in terms of domestic contribution. I can say that with hand on heart. So I was very lucky. So solid support from the nanny and solid support from husband, and both evenly distributed. So it kind of worked that way, but it was a lot of effort. And my experience is no different to other women, I'm sure, in terms of, you know, it's a lot of hard graft. You have to keep moving forwards, though. But the other thing I learned was that even if you feel half dead when you turn up to work, no one notices. So don't apologise too much.
I also feel that with my children. I felt as if they had a few years where I neglected them terribly. And quite frankly, now they didn't seem to notice. So I think,
well, yes, there is that. I did ask them questions early on, and in their sort of between the ages of 13 to 15, particularly these are girls, of course, they trowel it on you. But after they kind of forget, and then they sort of like the idea. It's a sort of badge of honour that their mum works, you know. There's a lot of so it's you can't win either way. So just don't birch yourself, and just you'll be, as Winnicott said, a good enough mother. That's the most important thing.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. And now also, what do you do to relax? And also, what are you going to say to these young women that are coming through that will keep them going and inspire them? So relaxing first.
Well, I suppose I mentioned early on that I had this arty sort of side. So my way of, I wouldn't say it's relaxing, is to paint. So I do quite a lot of my spare time, if I've got something at the weekend, is always with a brush in hand or some project or other. And it's been so fulfilling to be able to do more of that as time has gone on. So if you feel that, I guess the obvious point is that if you feel you've got some things there that you know are part of your identity and that perforce will be stifled a bit because medicine is so all-consuming and always on, and indeed childcare is always on, but try to give some oxygen to those things, because that way lies some kind of contentment, and otherwise things can just get too grim and it can bite you if you just deny this stuff. So permission to enjoy, permission to pursue, however, whatever it is. And I've been, it does keep me going, that extra thing. And I suppose the other thing is I run. Running is probably too overclaiming. It's probably jog every day. So, and that really does help.
Gosh, well, fantastic words of wisdom. Any more advice to the next generations coming through? I think you've actually probably already given them quite a lot of pearls.
Well, I think one thing, if you don't mind me saying, that I was, Jane, you and I recorded a podcast last week, and we had three women of different generations speaking, and the generations of doctors, and the youngest generation, the person who was in their 20s, I found really inspiring. And that's because what was interesting there is that people of my generation, I think, I don't know whether you think the same, Jane, had to super adapt in order to, you almost pull yourself out of shape in order to, because you felt you had to behave in a certain way in order to, you know, make progress or, and actually what's really nice to hear is that I think some of the younger generation don't want to pull themselves out of shape in that way. They actually want to give respect and airing to other parts of their experiences and identities which matter. And this is much more of a modern phenomenon, which I think is really healthy. So I would encourage people to do that. Clearly everyone has to adapt, but not to pull yourself out of shape is very important. So I'm really please keep going, younger people, if you're hearing this, and you don't have to compromise. The ground has been made, the running's been made by earlier generations. So hopefully you're able to give some more oxygen to other parts of your character that brings more of yourself to the work situation, and so that you don't have to deny things that are actually really quite important to you.
Thank you. So that's wonderful advice. So whoever's out there, remain you, be you. Don't allow the world to move you out of shape.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much. That's been really inspirational, and I'm sure people will really love listening to you whilst they're multitasking.
Indeed.
So thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for listening. There are many more Medical Women Talking in this series of podcasts. Please have a listen to some of the other inspiring women. You'll definitely find something to inspire you.